Hello, everybody, and happy Halloween. Welcome to the Stephen Hopkins Outtourism special Halloween edition. It's a Hopkins Halloween here at 24 Hours Don't Make an Ideology. We've been absent. You know, we've been in the basement, in the lab, like mad scientists, cooking up this one. You know, we've spent 5 months doing an enormous amount of work on this. It wasn't at all sort of slapped together at the last minute in the spirit of the season. This is very deliberate work. And as always, I'm your host, Ian, here with my co-host.
Ryan Swin, hello. And yeah, I mean, I think we did say at the end of season one that we had planned to do this whole Hopkins series. And I think this is something that we'll be doing as a recurring thing. Like, we realize that we don't necessarily have to do them all before we get to season two. So season two will come sometime fairly soon. But we realized that Hopkins' first two films are both horror films. And so we just couldn't resist putting this out on Halloween. And we're actually recording this on Halloween as well. So it's an extra layer of fun for that.
Yeah, we didn't want to leave Hopkins behind so soon because we won't really have occasion to talk about him as much later in the show. And, you know, he's got a career of feature films he's made. And we've actually got content for future Halloween specials. So, you know, consider this the first in at least a Halloween Hopkins series. But yeah, we hope to get around to all his films. But so, you know, look forward to our takes on Stephen Hopkins' 2016 film Race in approximately 4 to 5 years.
Yeah, there are definitely some interesting choices. I'll say that. There's some interesting choices, which even extends to just these two films, I think.
Yeah, I was making the argument on Twitter that, like, we don't... Like, Stephen Hopkins is kind of a journeyman a little bit. And, like, we have those guys, but... Now they do so much, like, they do a lot of big franchise schlock, and Stephen Hopkins does small franchise schlock. But yeah, I just, like, I think we need to find a normal way to celebrate mid directors like Hopkins, and that's what I see as the project of considering him as a director. It's just like, and of course he directs over a period in Hollywood that I think is really interesting, you know,
for his and really career. Conducive, yeah, really conducive for. Just like seeing the trends as it sort of moves away from the sort of, you know, standalone things. Of course, he did sequels as well, but I feel like looking at his filmography, at least from this bird's eye view, is like a lot more just standalone things, sort of very middling, unpretentious action things, which is something that he does well, I think, or at least does well in 24, that sort of right down the middle aspects. And so I think that seeing how it changes, seeing how he sort of stands as like this weird exemplar as the film and TV environment around him changes, I think is something that we'll explore in great detail over the course of however many episodes this ends up being.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's pretty great that you have a director that you can talk about as like both a kind of up-and-coming, you know, Aussie filmmaker who, you know, gets diverted by doing, you know, like the fifth Nightmare on Elm Street movie, and then end, or like not end because he's still alive and still making films, but at least for now, you know, bring that arc all the way up to making a Queeby movie.
Wait, I didn't realize he did a Quibi movie. I thought it was like a show or something.
Well, I think it all kind of comes together, you know. I think of it as a movie anyways. I haven't watched it, but I think it's like, I think the idea almost, like from reading about it at least, what's it called? Damn it.
Is it The Fugitive?
Yeah, The Fugitive. Yeah. I mean, the thing about having, you know, quote unquote episodes that are so short and then watching them all together is that, like, functionally they're like scenes, right? So what you really have is, like, because something like 24 definitely has the feeling of these are, even though it's heavily serialized, it the better episodes at least feel like complete arcs, things happening in the episode, like we talked about with season one, you know, the worst episodes where we're just kind of like dragging along in between like the plot moving. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you know, when an episode is like 6 or 9 minutes long, mm-hmm. like at that quick bite length, you're really just talking about, you know, making a scene.
I actually had completely forgotten that they were that short.
They're super, super yeah. short.
So, like, if you take the running time of the episodes are from 6 to 9 minutes. So, if you go generous and make it 9 minutes for all of them, it's 126 minutes.
Yeah,
like it's barely anything. Also, I realized that apparently one of the characters in The Fugitive is named Priti Patel.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
The real
wow, we've been through like two prime ministers since we last recorded, I think.
Oh yeah, there have been more prime ministers than seasons of 24 are covered on this podcast. and that number will continue to be mismatched, I think.
Oh yeah,
the real jewel of Hopkins' filmography that I don't think it's available anywhere, but I really want us to find, is his pilot for the Dark Tower TV show in 2019. that was scrapped.
Yeah, it's like one of the like the I don't know the like the Noah Baumbach thing that's lost, or the what's still
missing,
like
his, those pilots. The Corrections.
Yeah, The Corrections.
Yeah,
right.
yeah. Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. Oh, Idris Elba was supposed to be in it, was in the TV series, as long as I can tell.
Well, wasn't it like, okay, so they did the film, you know.
Yeah, You Want the Tower.
You Want the Tower. You know, for a film that I don't think, I think if you walked up to anybody on the street and asked them if they'd seen it, you would probably strike out a lot. But yeah. few films managed to endure in the sort of brain-rotted Twitter culture in the way that Dark Tower has. Yeah, but wasn't the idea that it would launch like a kind of big franchise thing between movies and TV shows? Like, that's what everybody wants to do now. Mm-hmm. And we sort of forget that just doesn't like automatically work.
Yeah, I think like it was just trying to do like the entire series.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the problem is you have to like make a good movie that people want to see and talk about.
That's true.
Yeah, or at least like a thing that makes enough money, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So today we are talking about Stephen Hopkins' first film, 1987's Dangerous Game. And his follow-up to that, 1989's A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Dream Child, which is the fifth entry in Nightmare on Elm Street, but which I refuse to call A Nightmare on Elm Street 5 because the title card just calls it The Dream Child.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, like, it's a... we'll get to it. I think we'll discuss the two in order.
Absolutely.
There's enough to talk about for each. I don't know how long this will actually be, but this is largely in good fun, of course.
Yeah. Dangerous Game is on YouTube, by the way. Yes. You should go watch it. It's a good time.
Yes. It's a pretty good time. You were talking about him as an up-and-coming sort of Aussie director, and it should be noted that one of the few entries on the Wikipedia page, according to Stephen Hopkins, the film sold well at Cannes because at that time it was quite cool to be Australian.
Yeah, so I really thought of this, and I don't know if this is at all true, but in my sort of like head canon version, Stephen Hopkins is sort of like second rate George Miller, right? Like everybody's looking for the next, you know, Mad Max, right? Mm-hmm. And Stephen Hopkins makes Dangerous Game, which I think could be argued kind of comes in that tradition.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Of like scrappy, kind of cheap but stylish, you know, Oz films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, or like even like a second rate Philip Noyce or something like that. Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, if you want to be mean about it.
not necessarily in a bad way. Just like it's, I don't know, Philip Noyce has plenty of stinkers also. But his first, like his first sort of internationally known film, which I covered on my other podcast, Newsfront, is more of a straightforward drama, some sort of interesting recreations and things like that. Yeah. But then you get him going towards the action route, and he becomes more known for action stuff than at least during the height of his career. But here, Hopkins, before 24, I don't think he did anything that was not in some genre. I think it was all thrillers or sci-fi or
yeah, horror films. I think he's kind of in that lane. Let's look at the filmography here.
Yeah, I think like the first thing. I feel like
there's maybe one that's borderline that I'm not remembering.
I mean, there's like a historical adventure film, Ghost in the Darkness.
Yeah, Ghost in the Darkness seems a little borderline. Mm-hmm.
But everything else is pretty straight down.
But you know, it's still got like Val Kilmer in it and
yeah.
Michael Douglas. Like, it's not like he went and made some kind of like touching melodrama or something somewhere in here. Yeah, he doesn't really. Let's see what it. It looks like he really doesn't even. It really isn't until Race that he even kind of steps out of.
Yeah, this kind I mean, of like genre there's this. Yeah, there's the Life and Death of Peter Sellers, which he did for TV.
Oh yes, yeah. Yes. Okay, yeah. I always forget about that one.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, the sort of weird division on Wikipedia between feature films and TV films.
Yeah.
Even though this is. Even though we will have a Cannes competition film that we'll be covering on this podcast.
Nominated for the Palme d'Or.
But yeah, for Dangerous Game, speaking of selling at Cannes to being in Cannes, that's another arc we'll get to cover.
Yeah.
But Dangerous Game, not to be confused with the Abel Ferrara film, it is, I mean, it's called a slasher. But there's only one person that dies in it, and it's by accident.
Yeah, it's sort of like... I actually think the setup is sort of interesting in that, like, imagine, you know, the usual setup for a slasher. It has all of the, like, set dressing mm-hmm. and wind-up for a slasher. Mm-hmm. But then the actual inciting event is so bizarre. Just a really dumb guy accidentally becomes a slasher villain because he kills this kid and then just snaps. And he's already like kind of on the edge.
Well, that's the thing. Like the film would, you know, I don't think it's decent. It's not that bad. But it sort of definitely telegraphs, like, it knows exactly where it's going, and it will make sure that you do not miss for a second where it's exactly going, which is charming in its way. Like, I feel like a lot of the stuff between the friends, between, like, especially the male friends, doesn't really come off, which is sort of a problem when a lot of the film is about that. But I feel like the film almost in a way peaks with its opening credits.
Yeah, the opening credits are great.
Yeah, like where it's like this very, like, it's this very abstracted showing of him putting on his boots, his cop uniform, his badge, his gun, and things like that. And
very stylish.
Like, yeah, very stylish, all in this against a black backdrop. And there's, I think, exactly one other time when that's sort of invoked, where he decides to roll the main character's a car into a no parking zone so he can give him a ticket.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is like, okay, this is definitely a kind of ACAB film, right?
But, oh yeah, I was thinking about that with Hopkins, is that like his sort of his ACAB-ish sensibilities that come out in points.
Well, and I sort of think I can kind of imagine a young, you know, sort of punk Hopkins, you know, hanging out with his friends, getting parking tickets. You know, I think he comes by it pretty honestly as far as a kind of a distrust of people who, you know, I don't think this is like a blanket thing for him, but a distrust of people in authority who misuse that authority against people that, like, you know, these are just kids kind of messing around. He seems, mm-hmm. unlike in 24, where that's like the most horrifying thing in the world is friends hanging out together, that like immediately we're sort of endeared to them by like the like, they're having like a squirt gun fight as they drive down the highway. It's just like pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's the first of like 500 fake outs that this film has.
Yeah. Well, here's what I would say is that, My opinion on genre exercises like this, right, is that if you're making a slasher, like, we know what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. I don't think this film spends a ton of time trying to not be what it is, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Like, we know pretty much from the opening credits, like, this is a bad guy, you know, from those opening scenes. We know that this is like not going to go well. I think what's interesting about the film are the surprising ways that it delivers the inevitable conclusions, right? Like, we know where this is going. There's no question about like plot wise, really, how this is going to shake out.
Mm-hmm.
But it does have some fun along the way, which I appreciate. You know, it seems like pretty like baseline for a genre film like this. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah. I think we should also say at this point that you're definitely the more familiar with horror, I guess, than I am, which is especially interesting considering the next film that we'll get to. But so please take my pickiness with a grain of salt when it comes to horror.
I think you're right. Like, okay, my attitude to horror of this level is that it's kind of a great throw it on movie.
Yeah,
to steal a term from Joker Man podcast. this is a throw it on movie where, like, I don't like you don't need to pay crazy close attention to this,
right?
You know,
mm-hmm.
But it's gonna give you some thrills and chills, and there's a couple cool shots, and the kids aren't too annoying.
Yeah,
it has a sort of novel location.
well, I was gonna say that this is his Nocturama.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, right? So there's like interesting things going on, but no, this is not, I don't want to make it sound like I loved this movie or anything, but it's just like, I can't, all of its flaws are sort of like baked in, I think, to what it is, and I can't hold any of them against it, because it makes it sort of, it indeed, like, I can see why those qualities would be, you know, this isn't like accidentally, you know, a masterpiece, like an Ed Wood film or something.
Sure, sure.
This is just like genre exercise by pretty competent director, fun production design, and like that's what it is. There's like there's so many of these movies is the thing.
Yeah. Like, oh yeah, totally.
There's just an enormous glut of these movies. And I don't really make it my business to watch all of them, but
yeah,
it's fun to throw one on.
Yeah, I mean like, Not to compare things too much to the present day, since I feel like we'll probably end up doing that anyways, but like it's the thing where these sort of films, either they go like when people watch them nowadays, or like when they watch new films that are sort of in this mold nowadays, they have to make it into like this massive thing, you know, like with Smile or with Malignant or things like that, where they have to make it this huge, you know, like groundbreaking must-see film.
Yeah.
And like, which is decidedly something that I don't think anyone would necessarily classify Dangerous Game as, but is this sort of, but like, you know, the inflation of the importance of the, of sort of low budget horror films has been, has definitely risen quite a lot, especially in recent years.
Yeah. I think there's a thing, you know, there's been a lot lately about, a lot of chatter about horror being like maybe the box office savior that Hollywood needs, blah, 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 you know, post pandemic. But I think the thing that's fundamentally different now from, you know, 1987 is that these things could be slapped together. You used to slap these things together real cheap, throw them out there. And they were like more or less disposable, but they were sort of like reliable. Again, they're not going to, maybe every once in a while you get a runaway hit. But you're just kind of throwing them out there. And now it feels like you were saying, everything takes on this higher importance because even a relatively cheap studio horror film still has a lot riding on it, you know? Like, I just saw, again, but on TV the other night, a trailer for The Menu, right? Which, okay, on the one hand, seems to have a sort of, like, again, like a sort of fun novel setup for a film like that, which is like, oh, all of these yuppies going to this super exclusive, you know, restaurant. Ralph Fiennes plays the killer cook. Like, that sounds like money right there.
Right,
but
right.
It seems to be trying to be too much, even from the trailer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, social commentary thing.
Yeah.
The fact that it has so many, you know, so many recognizable actors.
Yeah, I think someone made the point on Twitter the other day, and I apologize that I don't remember who, but that the real problem with elevated horror is not that it is taking these kind of like crude allegorical or social commentary angles. Like, that's not the issue. It's that it sort of, like, on the one hand, it elevates subtext to text, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't actually, usually, and there are exceptions. Like, I think Jordan Peele's very good.
Yes.
Even even when I don't always vibe with his throw everything at the wall approach, mm-hmm. I think he's like pretty smart and has a good like visual sense, which is another mm-hmm. thing that I think these films often lack. But it's sort of like elevating that subtext that's sort of always present in horror films to the level of text, and then kind of acting like you were really smart for doing this. Like, this is why I hate Midsommar. This is why I think Midsommar is one of the worst movies ever made.
Yeah.
Is because it's just constantly bludgeoning you over the head with, wow, look how smart and how cool and how stylish this movie is. But it's actually none of those things. Whereas something like Dangerous Game is not trying to do that at all. And sort of just like the whatever sort of social commentary elements are in here are just kind of a byproduct of the setup itself. Right.
Yeah,
there's this constant like reversal in horror between like subversion and like reification of you know, cultural norms, right? I think this is why so many non-white, non-male critics have kind of flocked to horror, even though it is maybe on the surface like one of the more reactionary genres, right? But it's because there's so much weird stuff going on beneath the surface because of how many of these things there are, how cheap they're made, and the sort of like possibility involved in these extreme setups.
Yeah, I like that idea of possibility. Like, it's definitely something that gets a little bit explored in Dangerous Game, but it doesn't like quite come as full force as I'd like. And I think that it's sort of key, but also sort of a liability for the film that applies to the killer also.
Yes, yeah.
Because he has, I mean, it's sort of, part of it is just how goofy the setup of him getting, like, of him getting wrapped up in all of this is. Just because he decides, after lurking around for like 30 minutes, then he decides to just come down walking down this kind of incredible sort of set of stairs that they have, like these metal stairs that they have in the back of the department store or something like that.
Yeah, big shout out to Igor Ney, the production designer. Probably the best quality of this movie.
Yeah, definitely. And he is wearing like this, like a mask and, you know, like this sort of wig or something like that, and he decides to just like start hitting mannequins with a baseball bat, and then he just starts hitting the sides of the stairs, and he's just walking so slowly. It comes off as too goofy for me. I just don't know quite what he was going for, especially since he immediately goes right to just throwing a knife at a target, which happens to hit the kid in the chest.
Yeah, I actually love that moment on the stairs.
it's funny. It's just, like, just, you know, in the context of everything else, especially because so much of the time has been dedicated to him being all scheming and raving and things like that.
Yeah, it feels so expressive in the way that these movies are often supposed to be. But then, as you said, it's sort of it's offset by the kind of ridiculousness of the way that we tumble into a full-on slasher, right? Which is like, and this is maybe the thing where the film is maybe overthinking its setup a little bit.
Yeah.
Where it's like, just give us like a killer cop movie. Like it almost feels the need to explain it. Like, we get this bit of backstory about how he actually has a grudge against the main character because the main character's father was like a cop who got this guy,
superintendent
demoted or something. So like, even then, it's sort of like even though it's kind of an ACAB movie, it's also a not all cops movie
No, totally. I mean, also, it's mentioned that he was in Northern Ireland at some point.
Yes.
So like, is this like movie, a Troubles commentary?
This movie is actually very racist against the Irish. I made a comment about that, and we know he's Irish both because of that comment, but then because shortly after that, he is, let me check my notes here. He becomes erratically violent, listens to incredibly Irish sounding music, and drinks Jameson out of the bottle.
Yes, he does drink Jameson right out of the bottle.
So the explanation for why he's a bad cop is because he's a Mick. That's why. That's the psychological explanation that
His last name is Murphy, and it gets said many times over the course of this film.
It, you know, it was, and again, it's like, it's the real flaw, I think, of this film is that it does not turn everything up to 11.
Yeah.
And that's maybe kind of like the Hopkins guarantees that nothing will ever get turned up to 11. Frankly, my criticism of the Nightmare movie is basically the same, which is that it that one gets closer to teetering right on the edge of like, oh man, we're gonna really go batshit here. Mm-hmm. But even there, it doesn't quite go all the way, which is which, you know, I think Hopkins is kind of a moderating presence as a director, which is, I guess, like in the character of the journeyman, you know.
Yeah, like it's sort of, I mean, you even get that just with the sort of laborious nature by which they, like, the friends decide on anything. It, like, each of their interactions just takes so much time for them to get talking about something, even though they've it seems like they've known each other for a while. I mean, like, especially the very obvious choice of making two couples and then one random guy.
Yeah, the fifth
wheel. So you know, yeah, the fifth wheel and the only one that actually dies.
The only one that dies. Yeah. And that's the thing, too, is that even as a slasher, it can't fully become a slasher. Yeah. You know?
Like, it's a slasher where the slasher ties his victims up for some reason instead of just killing them.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem like he's planning to just kill himself along with them just at the very start. Like, you know, this is... Like, I don't know when this plan came up for him. I mean, after the kid gets stabbed, of course.
Yeah, because sort of the inciting incident that kind of pushes him over the edge is that, you know, he gets in trouble for messing with these kids, right?
For crashing into their
motorcycles.
There are some, like, there are two, like, really fun stunts like that. There's like that one where he just goes flying off his motorcycle as he crashes into a row of motorcycles, and then there's like this Police Story-esque moment where he's standing on a like a glass cabinet in the middle of a row of glass cabinets, and then the main kid pushes them over. And it's, so, you know, there's definitely moments.
I think what this film needed is just, again, like a little bit less pretension toward making sense.
Yeah,
and it just needed, like, get those kids into that department store as quickly as possible with a cop who, you know, like, I mean, you wouldn't even need all the backstory and setup. He could just be a cop who got demoted, who has to now, like, patrol department store, and who just like loses his mind. You know?
I mean, like, I feel like there's many moments where it doesn't make sense to me. And it was like immediately after that glass cabinet scene. Like, it seems like he's sort of fallen under, but then they run away, and then they say they have to find him.
Yeah.
Like, they just keep running away from him and then saying they have to find him, which is sort of gets laborious after a while.
Yeah, it's pretty clumsy in the execution of the specifics because, and I think really it's because of the, we don't actually know how much of a malign force he is because the only kill in the movie is an accident.
Yeah.
Like, we know he's unstable. Yes. But then when it's sort of revealed that he isn't, you know, really killing the characters after that, then it sort of, that really kind of like deflates it a little bit, you know,
especially since there's so many scenes where he's menacing them with a knife or something.
Yeah, he's very good at menacing. Stephen Greaves, I guess.
He like
gives
that
a very fun performance.
Yeah, it's sort of like fun, like a very sort of bug-eyed thing, which I feel like he's too much in that already when the film starts for it to go in the directions that it does. But it is fun watching him with this sort of, these like rear projected images of him against like these, it's kind of fun in that way. There are actually a bunch of those weird flashes of images that don't really recur, like especially with one of the women. There's that that like shot of like a woman in like a pale-faced woman or something like that doesn't really get commented on otherwise.
Yeah, I think a lot of that, again, is just like we're supposed to be picking up some kind of maybe dramatic or tragic kind of backstory that's just so buried in the script that even the images that seem to be referencing it don't quite.
But
I will say that it... Okay, so one thing you have to know about this movie is that it takes place in a massive department store that also has like a Dr. Mabuse like control room in the middle of it. It's like very austere and brutalist. The production design is all over the place, but it's really great. It's so fun.
Yeah, it's really great. I mean, it's just the sort of thing where a lot of the film seems to take place on just one floor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so some of the floors maybe aren't as differentiated as I might like, but then there's, like, that weird, like Carnival Funland sort of place.
Yes,
with the jack-in-the-boxes that go off by motion sensor.
Yeah, like the children's toy store area. Yeah, and then that big, like, central atrium, like you were saying, with the staircase and stuff is very cool, and the big dramatic windows.
Yeah. Of course, the control room is brutalist, but it also has just, like, 50 flashing lights around.
Yeah, yeah, just...
And then all get destroyed by this, by one guy with a death rage of some sort.
Yeah,
Also, like, on the topic of terminals, it is fun that the film essentially, the setup essentially happens because a computer guy just wanted to drive a car too much.
Yeah, he wanted to impress girls.
Yeah, but, like... So when he gave the car, does that mean that he actually, like, it owns the car now, or is it just so he could drive it that one time?
You know, it's the whole. I think you nailed it. It's like the whole setup takes so long, and I just really lost interest in that part of the movie. Frankly, like, you know, it just seems like they had a much easier way to get us there, which is just like, oh, some teens have a party. Maybe they drink a little bit, and they decide, hey, let's go break into the department store because we can, you know.
What if the first 4 hours of 24 took place inside that mattress store?
Well, I did look at the mattress store quite a bit. I was like, this is like the same setup, but it's executed much better in 24 because it's just like, yeah, we're going to go party and break into a store because this guy we know works there. Like, I think my memory of it is dim, but I think at the time I was like giving that kind of a hard time as being sort of goofy.
Well, it's goofy.
What did you think of? How did you feel about the ending of this film? not the very last shot, which we can definitely talk about, but just like...
I mean, I feel the same way about the last shot and the ending.
Okay,
which is that it's very dumb. Well, no, it's dumb, but all, you know, parts of it are dumb in a not fun way. Parts of it are dumb in a very fun way.
Yeah,
like in. Sometimes the very fun way quickly turns to the not fun way, like especially the ending where the four of them are just blasting away at the store window with shotguns, and it's cool, but then they start cutting to, you know, flashbacks, and it takes like 3 minutes,
it's just
this real drag.
It is a little bit of a drag. It goes from being kind of this amazing cathartic moment to just like. Yeah, I liked, again, I think maybe, like, Hopkins was thinking, or the screenwriter as well, was thinking, a lot of times overthinking the setup, but I do like that the sort of, the trope of the final girl, which is already, in 1987, pretty prevalent, is already getting played with here, you know, which I think is interesting.
First of all, this film does have a lot of slow-mo, even for... Like, for the stunts, it makes sense, but for a lot of the other parts, it feels like it's just trying to prolong things.
Yeah, they're really trying to get to feature-length runtime. But it's 98 minutes. Like, this, I really think this movie could have been a really solid 80 minutes.
Yeah, it definitely feels too long in that regard.
98 is too long.
Yeah. And just, especially when it's just pulling it out before she, instead of deciding to... rack the shotgun, she just starts beating him with it.
Yeah.
It's just this, and then after that, then they all suddenly decide they don't want to go in.
Yeah,
it's just like this real... I would have actually really liked to have seen them just burst in with shotguns, but we're denied that, unfortunately.
Yeah, some, you know, I would say that this movie has the energy level of like a relatively pleasing, you know, TV movie. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it doesn't. The scenes aren't quite tight enough.
Mm-hmm.
There's some slack energy that mostly comes from just like characters having to talk a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's also
fun, goofy moments that sort of liven it up.
Yes.
I think the funniest but also the most aggravating one to me was when there's that mannequin that's randomly hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah. Which is like a pretty great gag, but also completely nonsensical.
Yeah, and then it's immediately followed up by the guy pretending or having fallen asleep, and they think he's dead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, just all around some strange choices.
Yeah, I mean, like, cool choices become sort of goofy once they actually get played out, as most of them do. Like, yeah. when there's that fight between the cop with a knife and the kid with a handheld blowtorch.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
and then they're just flailing at each other for a while before then he sets him and then the crossbow on fire.
Yeah, that's the sequence on the roof, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sequence is interesting.
Yeah, and then first the guy confidently ties himself to climb down to get him, and then he's just becomes really scared when he's trying to chase the kid before the kid falls off.
Yeah, yeah.
The kid's like going to climb across like 50 feet of
on a telephone wire or something. Yeah. And then it breaks, and that's where he crashes through the window, right?
Yeah.
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 Which is pretty cool. Like, again, like, there's moments where it's like, this is really stupid, but then mm-hmm. something, like, visually... and again, a lot of this is getting carried by the set design, mm-hmm. which is fun, even though, yeah. again, it's sort of, like, lax, maybe mm-hmm. even an internal logic to, like, what this building looks like. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Is this building, like, 15 stories high, or is it, like,
yeah, I couldn't tell. Like, the only... Like, even though there's a directory, there's only a shot of specifically the third floor.
Yeah.
Even though it looks like there's probably at least 10 floors or something. But
yeah, yeah. Because when they're on the top of the building, it seems like they're very high up.
Right, right. And everything else seems like, you know, the spaces sort of blending to each other. It's more about the look of the spaces than the geography. Like, I have no clue where that bed is, where they get up to, even though apparently they were very... sort of timid around each other to get down a bit this extremely quickly.
I totally forgot about that. Yeah. 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 Again, it's just like, it's kind of like, it knows all the beats it needs to hit as a slasher.
Especially the sort of the pervy killer.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah. He does not like being laughed at by girls.
Yes.
That makes him very angry.
I did come to actually sort of appreciate just how blatantly they were like during the scene when the computer hacker is trying to convince him that they'll be on his side, and then he sort of misreads every single mishears every single word.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it's just like, you know, I think they needed a little more confidence in their setup.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just to be like, yeah, people will buy into this. I mean, mm-hmm. it is astonishing to me that it knows all of the, like, all the tropes of the slasher are there.
Yeah.
And they're trying to use them or reuse them or change them up in a way that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they still feel like too much of a need to explain all this stuff to their audience. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. There's that long scene in the classroom at the beginning that...
Yes.
where this professor is just intoning about Tiberius, I think.
Interminable. Yeah.
Interminable.
Just a scene... I mean, the whole sequence of the school of, like, these constant conversations about, like, yeah. oh, we're going to go over here, hey, we're going to do this. It's like, all that could have been dispatched in, like, 30 seconds, but instead we spend, like, 10 minutes on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even the squirt gun fight goes on. Is twice as long as it needs to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's like an opening credit sequence that could really work if it mm-hmm. just was chopped up a little bit, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of stuff like that in here.
Yeah.
Which it kind of makes the ending even funnier, because it's just like this one shot of him after, like, he's put a shotgun barrel in his mouth. He suddenly decides to just stagger away from the department store.
Yeah, it's got a great stinger, you know.
Yeah,
sort of like that kind of shocking moment. That feels much more like a sort of meta horror moment in that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's like not even necessarily. It's sort of like at the end of Halloween, right? Yeah. Which is that,
or, you know, like end of Thriller or something.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Very end of Thriller for mm-hmm. sure. Where it's just like, really what this is like one last scare, right? It's not like, like the plot can just be thrown out the window. The possibility of a sequel is maybe not even the reason that it's there. Just like, we want one last good kind of freak out, you know?
That's on the more endearingly dumb side of this.
Oh, film. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like, I guess there's a difference between like dumb and stupid, and that's stupid. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about Nightmare on Elm Street, the Dream Child now?
Yes. Which we have to note first off that These are both. This is both of ours' first Nightmare on Elm Street film. Okay. And I only watched half of it. I, like, not because I didn't like it. You know, it's fine. Like, what I've seen is fine, kind of fun. But I just didn't have. I just ran out of time to watch all of it.
Yeah. So I would say two things. One, I don't. You know, the thing about these horror franchises is you really don't need to know what's going on. Because they all do kind of have to reestablish what's going on.
Yeah.
Because of the way that they were made, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, okay, yes, this is the fifth Nightmare on Elm Street movie, but also, when was the last time anybody saw the other four? We kind of have to do a little catch up. And also, like, you know, he's Freddy Krueger. Like, we know who that is. We know what he does. He's a spooky guy.
Yeah.
He's got the glove thing,
right?
The sweater, right? Like, there's not that much to know. This is not, you know, this is not a complicated sort of thing. So everything that I know about Nightmare on Elm Street, aside from just it being kind of in the ether, comes from the Mr. Bean short film, the Mr. Bean short where he goes to see, I think, the first nightmare, maybe not the first one, but one of the nightmares. I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be. And he gets too scared by it. So I saw that as a child. And at some point in my brain, that got transmuted into, maybe I've seen Nightmare on Elm Street, but I'm very confident that I have not actually seen Nightmare on Elm Street.
Apparently, so this is from the episode of Mr. Bean is called The Curse of Mr. Bean.
Yes, okay.
Arriving at the cinema, Bean prepares to watch a horror film, which appears to be titled A Nightmare. The film poster shown is that of A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Dream Child.
No way. Yeah. Are you kidding me? That's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
The camera is placed to cut off the last words, but yes. Apparently Freddy Krueger is on the poster, so.
Yeah, no, I know for sure that it was Freddy Krueger. That makes sense time-wise for sure. Wow.
So you actually did see parts of this before.
Wow, so Stephen Hopkins way embedded into my childhood in a way that I just didn't know.
Yeah,
was possible.
Yeah. Mm. Apparently, that episode also has a scene at a swimming pool.
Yes.
So there's a plenty of connections there.
Yeah.
Did you read the critical response section of Nightmare on Elm Street, the Dream Child?
Is this on the fan wiki?
No, on just the regular wiki.
I know I did at some point.
Okay. I have a quote that I want to read.
Yeah, please do.
Yes. Using a style heavily indebted to music videos, lots of fast cutting, odd angles, and gratuitous camera movements, Hopkins keeps the energy level up, though his manner is a bit too choppy to keep all the diverse elements together. Now, guess who wrote that?
Pauline Kael.
Dave Kerr. Yeah. Yeah, the wiki specifically characterizes it as praise the direction of director Stephen Hopkins.
That's great. Dave Kerr approved director Stephen Hopkins.
Yeah. There's also a long quote from an interview with Robert Englund, recalling the experience working with Hopkins. I met Stephen Hopkins, who's like the handsomest man in Hollywood at a time.
The first thing you have to know about Stephen Hopkins is that he's extremely hot.
I mean, I don't really see it, but it's a very funny gesture anyways.
Yeah.
At a Thai restaurant in Culver City, Stephen was doing storyboards and he's such a great illustrator that I just said, take me now. He goes, I want this whole sequence to be like M.C. Escher. I went, oh, perfect for a dream sequence. I get it. That's all he had to say to me and show me his doodle on a napkin and I was hooked.
Yeah, I do think, okay, so, you know, I'm flying a little bit blind here, but everything I read does indicate that, you know, this entry really took the sort of gothic stuff and turned it up. Which, you know, is to Hopkins' credit. We were just talking about how he doesn't tend to make things go all the way. But I do think there's a lot working here on just a level of, like, pure style to keep the material visually compelling and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like, from what I saw, like, there's some pretty interesting sequences that sort of run up against the sort of incoherence of it.
Yeah.
Like, it as totally incoherent as that scene of her taking a shower, then getting thrust into that asylum.
It's so sick to be like, okay, upcoming director Stephen Hopkins, we're giving you, you know, the keys to the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, and he's immediately like, we're doing Psycho. Yeah.
Like, well, I mean, like, I know there's that famous scene where the Freddy comes up from, like, his clock comes out from the bath.
In the bathtub. The first one. Yeah.
So I thought that was going to happen with the shower drain somehow.
Yes, yeah.
Instead, it just gets absolutely flooded.
Yeah. It's very, that sequence was sick. I liked it a lot. But we do need to talk about the bonkers opening credits. Which are, like, a completely abstracted sex scene.
Yeah.
That, decontextualized from the rest of the movie, you would have, like, I'm not even sure you would know what it was.
No,
until maybe
not.
The last few seconds of, it's very strange.
Yeah, it's like this, it's like a lit like Manhunter. It has just like this, you know, or you know, like it is just like, you know, mostly of bellies for some reason. I feel like there's a significant focus on bellies. Like
I straight up do not even know what body parts were. It's like all blue tinted. It's almost like a silent film type.
Oh yeah.
Blue tint.
Or maybe Day for Night or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just like undulating limbs and torsos.
Yeah, it's not passionate. It's just like,
no, it's terrifying. It's like, it's really alien. And what's so weird is that I reading from the context of the movie, it is sort of meant to be a kind of loving, you know, passionate sequence. But because of the, like, you know, so there are like two pregnancies in this movie that are of import, and it's, you know, baby Freddy Krueger and the main character's pregnancy, which is revealed in, I guess, kind of the first third of the film.
So
this opening sequence, I think, is kind of trying to, like, I think it's abstracted so much because in some sense it's kind of supposed to just like represent the abstract concept of like the danger and possibility inherent in new life, but because it's literally these characters who, you know, are supposed to love each other and who we're supposed to care about, at least in some sense, it is very weird, the sort of alien kind of grotesque tone that it sets in the first minutes.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's a strange, like, it, you know, sort of fits in with that those abstracted credits in Dangerous Game.
Yeah, very of a piece with that.
Yeah, but then the context is completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, strange.
Okay, wait, so I have a question, because I need to know, where did you see skateboarding Freddy Krueger, or did you not make it?
No,
that
I
far
didn't.
In the film?
I didn't get that. Okay. I'll finish after this.
Okay. if you watch it again and want to just like record your thoughts as a supplement to this episode, I'd be interested.
Yeah, I mean, I did. I was very. It was very fun to see the Tetsuo the Iron Man esque sequence.
Yes.
It's so good.
This movie. Oh, man, the more I talk about it, the more I think maybe I actually did straight up just really like
it. Yeah.
It's like, it corrects a lot of problems with Dangerous Game, which is that it's a bunch of interesting, weird sequences strung together with, you know, the barest bones plot and character, but it inverts the ratio, which is that it, like, gives us the, it's very expedient in getting us from one weird sequence to another.
Yeah.
Like, the way that we get, you know, the friends different, really grotesque and disgusting. I mean, like, the force-feeding death is one of the most grotesque things I've ever seen. And it's, like, it's all just cartoonish enough to pass, I think, is not, like, totally, because it's in this gothic mode. But those sequences are just so nutty and fun.
Yeah, I mean, like, you have basically just that one scene of the new friends. I didn't actually realize the new friends were not in the previous film, but I guess they're not. So you literally just get those, like, two scenes of setup before you have Alice falling into a waking dream.
Yes.
Which I really liked. That scene was quite cool, like, how it transitioned from her looking at the kids jump roping to that, you know, gradually being swallowed by darkness.
Yeah, it's very cool. And of course, you know, the main character's name is Alice and she wasn't even, I think that, like, I remember reading that Hopkins was really the one who kind of wanted her to be the center of the next film. And both her and the actor that plays her boyfriend, whose name I don't remember, were kind of invited back for this film kind of unexpectedly.
Yeah, I don't know how much continuity there is between. I mean, I know like there's the main character of the first one, but otherwise, I'm not exactly sure.
My impression is basically that you don't even need that, right? It's like it's sort of like somehow the Emperor has returned, right?
Yeah.
Except it's Freddy. It's like it's a new Nightmare movie. We know, you know, we defeated him in the last one, but not really actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any kind of real internal logic to the way that Freddy comes back, other than this kind of like both his sort of like metaphorical rebirth within the dream, which also ties to his backstory of his birth. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason this entry in the franchise is probably more maligned, in my opinion, than it deserves mm-hmm. to be, mm-hmm. is that it takes a franchise that seemed to be pretty mythos light and just dumps a bunch of mythos. But I think it, in its defense, and I know that's kind of an annoying move to make for a franchise like this, but in its defense, I do think that because of the demands of like, we need to bring this villain back, like mm-hmm. it does try to find some thematic resonances for that mythos, even if mm-hmm. at the end of the day it's just sort of like more kind of horror grotesquery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like it's sort of feeling, I mean, I just like how it captures that feeling of falling into a waking dream, like that sort of the, I mean, you know, dream logic, obviously that like, you know, the connection is literally text, but it is still the way it proceeds through that opening sequence, it just moves well. I don't know. There's just a feeling of it at like things, like the way it sort of pulls characters in a way that, you know, pulls characters into this trance or this compulsion to need to follow through with things.
Yeah.
Even like it certainly handles that much better than Dangerous Game.
Yeah. Every moment becomes suspect because we mm-hmm. as viewers don't know at each moment if the thing is literally happening or mm-hmm. if it's not, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is a very exciting tension to have in a movie like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, again, that like gothic sort of cartoonish almost sensibility that Hopkins chooses to go with here is really to the benefit of mm-hmm. that. Like, we get these exterior shots of the asylum that mm-hmm. are like out of a Roger Corman film. You know? Like, they're really fun and cool and over the top.
I think there's like a really cool matte painting at some point.
Yeah.
Like during that, when she's going into the asylum.
Yeah. Yeah.
From the forest. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like a franchise going really big on mm-hmm. a certain type of look that maybe, again, because of my limited experience, this is a little bit conjecture, but from what I can tell, you know, the previous entries in the series don't quite have that kind of big overawing sense of mm-hmm. of the gothic, right?
Right. I don't think we get that much time for, I mean, there are other horror films that Hopkins does. I don't know to the extent to which those go gothic.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's his mode normally. I'm not sure exactly. I have a guess here, which is that I think that there is one, I'm thinking about Hopkins' age, and I can kind of see those kind of 60s, early 70s kind of cheap drive-in movies being maybe something that resonates with him as horror, mm-hmm. right? Which is why in some ways this film is like, it's a weird mix of kind of old school horror stuff and also like very tasteless, like 80s horror stuff, which is kind of a fun mix. But I think also it's an excuse for him to do a lot of fun stuff with the camera, which he also does a little bit in Dangerous Game.
Yeah, you know? Like mainly like sort of like big crane movements, lots of handheld and following shots.
Yeah, some fun like whip pans. And,
yeah.
And I think he just like has fun with Freddy, who is not, mm-hmm. I think he has a kind of correct, like a kind of interestingly correct reading of Freddy, which is that he's not really a scary guy. He's mm-hmm. just a huge asshole.
Yeah. Which is of course one of the things that a lot of, I feel like this is another reason why the people who love Nightmare on Elm Street don't like this one.
Yeah. 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 Like, but I mean the, you know, like to me, Michael Myers is scary because of the opacity, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like Freddy is so over the top. Like there's like there's too many things going on. There's the kind mm-hmm. of iconic fit. You've got the claw glove thing. Mm-hmm. You've got the scarred up face. You know, it's like they've gilded the lily so much. And Hopkins is sort of saying, okay, well, this is like a cartoon character. This isn't, you know, this isn't some kind of an elemental horror, mm-hmm. right? It's a very kind of childish one.
Right.
And so, yeah, he just makes him like a guy who swears a lot and does like very cruel, ironic, you know, Dante's Inferno type deaths. Like, it's fun. It's a good time.
Yeah. I mean, like, you have like, there's two separate times where her boyfriend gets consumed by cars, basically. Yeah. Or like, he, you know, like there's that first time when he just makes a steering wheel for himself and then yes. starts to pour champagne on himself. And then there's that bike scene.
Yeah, and I love the bit where Freddy rips his arm off, connects it to the wall of the truck, and uses his own arm as a seatbelt. That's just a kind of visual humor that, I don't know, I just have a good time with that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's so over the it's like, this is kind of like a live action, you know, like Looney Tunes, yeah. almost. Mm-hmm. Which kind of, you know, it literally becomes a kind of comic mm-hmm. book at the end. Mm-hmm. You haven't seen the end of the film, but you know, the one sort of nerdy friend who draws comic books, you know, he's sort of like, he's able within the dream to kind of imagine himself into being this comic book character he's created in order to try and fight Freddy. It's very over the top and like yeah, yeah. kind of stupid. Like it mm-hmm. does seem like the kind of, again, like this is something I think we recognized in 24. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like a moment where Hopkins is like a little bit out of touch with the youth. And it's like, what are the youth yeah. like? They like comic books. And so comic yeah. books become, for some reason, this big part yeah. of the movie.
Speaking of which, I mean, and speaking of the gothic part, this came out a year after Batman, the Tim Burton one.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I wonder, I don't think it's unlikely to say that there's a good deal of inspiration from Batman.
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, a kind of interesting... like if you took this and mm-hmm. if you took Batman and like Little Shop of Horrors, mm-hmm. which are all kind of in sequence as these kind of big last gasps of big sets, you know, big set pieces, very stagey, very artificial looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like, you know, Burton's Batman Returns is maybe the one of the very, very last ones of those mm-hmm. that we get before things scale down. And CGI starts to open up different kinds of possibilities.
Yeah, that sort of Baroque sensibility, or that sort of overstuffed sensibility.
Yeah.
That, of course, gets, you know, turned up even further in the Schumacher films.
Yeah, yeah. But even the Schumacher films definitely have more of that, but somehow the... where they take... like, the sets literally feel smaller.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Like, they don't... like, Burton is able to make those sets feel endless.
Mm-hmm.
And the Schumacher films, which I have a huge affection for, do feel a little more contained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like the asylum set here feels huge.
Yeah,
yeah. Like Hopkins is able, like even in Dangerous Game, where of course, obviously the set, one of the largest made for Australian film at the time. Even if the geography isn't, you know, very, very well done, even like the corridors feel big.
Yeah.
Partly it's the height. Those feel big.
And yeah.
That's a sort of interesting, like if we try to think about that in connection with television, especially with 24, because 24 is oftentimes like more on the claustrophobic side, partly by, you know, the nature of the spaces, but I feel like that's sort of interesting also.
I was thinking of the CTU set.
Yeah.
And how mm-hmm. I think Hopkins sometimes shoots that in a similar way a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As a space with a lot of angles, a lot of repetition that makes it seem bigger than it maybe is, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because even, you know, the like you know, this film has a textual reason for eschewing a kind of straightforward geography in the spaces, mm-hmm. because this is like an asylum that's a representation of a real asylum where Freddy was born, but is also mm-hmm. well within like the dreamscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, we get these like endless corridors, and then it's like the big chapel and the surgery rooms and the sort of like the pit with all the mm-hmm. like we get these really grotesque spaces. But yeah, I was thinking about how Hopkins uses space in 24. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the CTU set is really the only set in that, mm-hmm. you know. That's, I mean, true, there's yeah. other sets, but everything else is like pretty, you know, mm-hmm. we're inside a car, or
yeah,
going mm-hmm. down some streets, or we're inside yeah. of another building that, you know, doesn't have the kind of, because of like the nature of TV production, mm-hmm. it's like the CTU set could like runs through the whole show, so they mm-hmm. you put a lot more time into that.
Right, right. Though to be fair, also the Jack Bauer's house seems weirdly large.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Well, you know, he burnt all those years off books for CIA, right? I really love the, in the Nightmare movie, I really do love the just sheer amount of weird practical effects we get.
Yeah.
You already talked about the motorcycle transformation, which is great. But also just like baby Freddy Krueger, which is like a stupid, such a stupid premise, but really grotesque looking.
Yeah.
Really just... gross. I mean, they really went all in. They didn't.
It's just like just aged enough.
Yeah, it has like the exact percentage of cuteness that makes it uncanny, which is like 1.2% of like cuteness that you're just like, this is the grossest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, you know, like it's sort of like the, I mean, just the way, you know, it waddles, like the chest burster in Alien.
Yes. Yeah.
Like it has that similar thing. Yeah. Also, just seeing him growing up as Freddy, just the quick transformation of that is also really fun to watch.
Yeah,
especially since it takes place against that window.
Yeah,
there's some good staging. Oh, and just the chapel.
Beautiful. Yeah, another great Windows movie along with Dangerous Game.
Oh yeah, remember in Dangerous Game the weird mirrors that are everywhere?
Yes, yeah. Well, like, you know, it is a department store.
Yeah, but, I mean, there's that, like, especially one shot where they're like, where it's looking at them in the mirror, but then it's not revealed until they run past.
Yeah,
like it's like that shot in the first episode of 24 where that when it's looking at the table, then it pans up to to his face.
That's so good. Okay, so this is a movie that I think exemplifies the interesting problems of horror subtext, right? Which is that it's like it's all about like birth and pregnancy and it's also like, I mean, we get an extremely sort of like the very tasteless, borderline offensive setup, you know, is that Freddy's mother was a nun who was assaulted by an inmate of the asylum. And out of this, you know, quote unquote, unholy union comes Freddy Krueger, you know, and of course they're Catholic, so there's no abortion. And he's born and, so on the one hand, there's like this reading you can do where it's like a kind of like pro-choice kind of reading.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, you know, we have Alice and her pregnancy and we get this sort of like weird, like a scene that kind of sticks out in the film because other scenes don't really have this quality of like her talking about, you know, keeping the baby and how it's inside of her and she can feel its life and stuff. And then, of course, like the kid himself becomes kind of manifest as this force. Ultimately is against Freddy. But all of this, the reason I'm gearing up for this is because apparently this concept for the film was actually floated for the fourth installment. But one of the big producers on the film, whose name I have written down, Sarah Risher, was pregnant at the time and she thought it was pretty distasteful. After having her child, however, she was like, oh, okay, I get it. And greenlit the film, which I think is really funny. The original draft of the script actually had some kind of setup where the kids in the high school would be putting on a version of Medea as the high school play, which would have been incredible.
There's also just like the sort of, there's other, you know, I mean, like, especially there's the friend who's, parents want her to become a model, you know.
Yes.
that additional idea of femininity and things like that.
Yeah.
Also the like 50s style diner in that Alice works at.
Oh, it's so great. yeah this movie really is all over the place.
Yeah.
But I think the only real knock, the only thing that keeps me from totally loving it is that it does, even at 90 minutes, it does start to drag a little bit in the finale. And I can't quite pinpoint why that is, because everything on paper is so fun and over the top as I think about it. I don't know, maybe I was just tired and I need to watch it again. Someday I'll watch all the Nightmare films and I'll rewatch this one. But
yeah,
it's just got so many, even when I was kind of like, you know, maybe like getting a little over it, or like, I didn't get tired of it, but when I was getting close, even then there was still like something interesting visually that was going on. I think maybe what it is the little kid stuff doesn't quite work. And they didn't let him say, fuck you, Krueger. That was the original line and they got a hard no from the MPAA on that. And that's a real shame, because I think that would have been a fun moment. Apparently Hopkins really went over the top with the gore in the original cut, because the MPAA apparently came in and threatened them with an X rating, which, you know, they really had to... I think they should have gone for it. I mean, it's pretty grotesque as it is, so I have a hard time imagining what exactly tipped it over into that territory, but...
Yeah, like, I think it was probably just, like, additional effects.
Yeah, or, like, maybe closer shots of some of the some of the grosser stuff. This also has an incredible end credits song drop.
Oh, really?
I don't want to ruin the moment for you, because I want you to watch the film.
There's some incredible possibilities in this soundtrack. There's a Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter.
Yeah.
Heaven in the Backseat. There's Can't Take the Hurt. There's Living in the Jungle. These are some interesting possibilities.
Yeah, the end credits song drop is entirely unexpected, tonally off, and like really brilliant. I cackled with delight when it began. I'm glad you mentioned Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, though. Because that's such a great title for a song. It's Bruce Dickinson, who's from Iron Maiden. I think Iron Maiden eventually recorded a version of that.
This and then the next film are the only like full-on franchise films that we have in this. I guess you could count Lost in Space, but that's an adaptation of the show.
Yeah.
So like these are like, it's interesting, you know, obviously I have more familiarity with Predator, albeit it's been a while since I've seen it, but like it's interesting to see, or to surmise at least, for in our case, about like the differences between the house style or what came before, because Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, Wes Craven was such a, you know, a clear force in it.
And very different from someone like Hopkins. Mm-hmm. Something that I think is interesting is that, you know, I do this as much as anyone, but there's always kind of complaints about, because of the contemporary, you know, Hollywood landscape, you get a lot of up-and-coming filmmakers who are really just trying to get their franchise, you know, entry, make the big bucks on, you know, Jurassic Park 5 or Marvel 23 or whatever. I think there's something to the fact that that's not a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
But that in the past, it was... Yeah, you did have, like... This is obviously, you know, a Nightmare on Elm Street film, but it does bear a kind of mark of... Like, they brought in Stephen Hopkins to do what Stephen Hopkins does and let him make his kind of, like, interpretation, adaptation of the material. And that's kind of the thing that doesn't happen anymore as much. Although that being said, I think that like there is an interesting parallel in that really, you know, the kinds of filmmakers that are jumping to these franchises now are not really very interesting filmmakers. And as much as I like Stephen Hopkins, I think he's kind of an analog to that. A guy who made kind of a middling, interesting kind of slasher in Australia. Someone you can scoop up cheap enough that they're worth, you know, putting on the fifth Nightmare on Elm Street movie, right? But who's also going to bring, like, a competency and a flair to it. That's the part I think that's lacking now, is just that, you know, while a lot of these directors are, like, you know, maybe, quote-unquote, as talented as Stephen Hopkins, right? there's not really any space to kind of do what he did here, which, you know, seems to be a fairly radical departure in some respects from what the franchise was doing.
Yeah, and it's, well, especially because not to belabor the point, but just that a lot of the filmmakers who are getting hired for Marvel things are people who have not made genre films.
Yeah.
It's interesting to track that, and especially to see how long that persists, if it persists to race.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting because like the Russo brothers...
Also TV guys.
Yeah, but doing genre riffs on TV, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, in Community. That's, like, an interesting new phenomenon, too, I think. Where it's, like, they didn't do what you would have done in the past, which is, make a kind of cheap genre film, you know, horror film, thriller, whatever.
Yeah.
they like know all the references already, so they did it on a TV show that was knowingly playing with those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they hadn't done the thing itself, which mm-hmm. is maybe, you know, maybe that's an argument to just like let more cheap genre schlock proliferate. You know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We also neglected to mention that Hopkins was the second unit director on Highlander.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna ask you in the episode, but since you brought it up, I was gonna ask if we should ever, you know, watch Highlander as part of our Stephen Hopkins series. I do think I've seen Highlander at some point.
I haven't. I just always treasure the knowledge that Christopher Lambert is blind.
Yeah. I don't know how you would even begin to, you know, watch a film for the fingerprints of an assistant director. But.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, there's ones where, like, it's all about the assistant director, like, you know, a lot of the Bonds, for instance. Beyond that, I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah. But yeah, I wonder if he was doing, like, you know, he was shooting, like, the location establishing shot type mm-hmm. stuff. And, mm-hmm. and that. Any more thoughts on...
Not especially.
Elm Street, Dream Child?
I feel like I probably should have actually seen the previous films just to get a better sense of how much Hopkins brought to it. But
you know, I don't think we missed a lot. I feel like not a ton, not plot-wise. I feel like the sort of reaction, you know, I think fandoms, especially horror fandoms, kind of tend to coalesce around certain mm-hmm. Interpretations of the franchises themselves, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's always like, you know, there's a certain privileging of the original for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you don't even rank that one if you're going to rank them, because it's like you can't think about it that way. And then there's always like a kind of critically maligned but beloved among the fandom entry, and then mm-hmm. there's usually one that is both critically maligned and hated by the fans. And this seems to be in that third category, but I would like to put it up for consideration of the second category.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I think it's very interesting. I don't think it's like a Halloween 3 level of we need to reclaim this.
But yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I could make an argument for loving this. It's weird, and I don't know. I just love big sets and ridiculous, like, artifice.
Yeah.
It's got all that stuff.
Yeah.
So
especially because it feels integrated. I think that's an important thing. Like, it feels integrated into what the film is trying to do. Yeah. I think that's definitely a mark for it.
Yeah. It's got a lot of texture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of, yeah, like you're saying, and a really interesting coalescing of style and theme that...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so worthwhile. You know, if you're listening to this on Halloween night and you're like, what should I throw on? I recommend A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Dream Child.
Yes, absolutely. There should be a 24 set on Halloween.
It's such a bummer that there's not. Now that
it's such a bummer. Yeah,
it should have all been on holidays.
Yeah. Yeah, like
I mean, you start Christmas with Election Day, which is like kind of, you know, why isn't there 4th of July 24? You have big fireworks finale.
Now I'm imagining the like a 24 set on yesterday for Bolsonaro being kicked out.
That's so good. Well, I just love the idea that like everybody comes into work with costumes on, and then something bad happens. Of course, like Jack's not wearing a costume. Everybody gives him shit for it. But then throughout the whole show, he's giving everybody else shit for like, hey, wish you wouldn't have worn a costume to work, right? You know, you don't work at like, you know, an office, like normal offices. You knew that something could go down, you know?
Yeah.
I am kind of hoping that like we don't get a 24 reboot for like another 10 years, but then mm-hmm. 10 years from now, we get kind of a grizzled Kiefer and Stephen Hopkins coming back together for another 24 entry.
Please, if you do decide to dress up as Jack Bauer tonight, please send us pictures.
That would be so great. I don't even know how you'd do that other than like have a gun, have a badge, like a CTU type thing.
Yeah, I know, like he has some good shirts.
He does have some good shirts. That's true. That's true. It'd really be in the shirt game.
Yeah.
We thank you all for your patience as we've taken this hiatus, and we hope you enjoy our Halloween musings, and yeah, we'll be back with season 2 hopefully not too long from now.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, everybody.